The final investigator I chatted with was Dr. Robert Ozols, who discussed with me patients from his practice, beginning with an older woman who underwent debulking surgery and actually participated in the landmark GOG-218 trial discussed during this program.
This was a 70-year-old woman who had the usual symptoms that lead to development of ovarian cancer with abdominal bloating and distension. And after a series of workups, she was found to have ascites, which was the hallmark of her case, and then that led to a CAT scan. And she turned out to have advanced stage disease and was sent to Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia and underwent surgery. Had advanced stage ovarian cancer and was optimally debulked. Most of the disease was removed. There wasn't very much disease left. But there was clear-cut macroscopic disease left behind. So we talked about the options for treatment for her, and she decided to participate in the GOG study 218, which was a three-arm randomized trial comparing paclitaxel carboplatin as a standard arm with paclitaxel carboplatin second arm with bevacizumab, and the third arm with paclitaxel carboplatin with bevacizumab during the chemotherapy as well as maintenance chemotherapy for about 14 months.
Now, when did she present?
This was about 3 years ago.
And was intraperitoneal therapy thought about for her?
We thought about intraperitoneal therapy with her. That's one of the options that is available for women with optimally resected disease. But most of us at Fox Chase feel that the potential benefits of participating in a trial where there was the option of getting bevacizumab outweighed the possible benefits of intraperitoneal therapy. And we'll talk about later, I think intraperitoneal therapy still remains to be fully evaluated and confirmed as a better approach than intravenous chemotherapy.
Right. I know your third case gets into that. I was just kind of curious whether the lady was healthy, no major comorbidities.
No, and then the question was, she was very interested, and her family was very interested in having what would be the best possible therapy. And at that point, we talked about the fact that bevacizumab in phase two trials had shown some very promising results. And other than trying to get bevacizumab off-label, the only way she possibly could get bevacizumab would be to participate in this trial. And there was a 2 out of 3 chance that she would get bevacizumab, and she fully understood that this was a placebo-controlled trial, which made it very interesting, and that the control arm was intravenous placebo, including maintenance placebo for the extended period of time. But she understood that completely and decided to participate in the trial, and she obviously hoped that she would get bevacizumab, and it turned out she did.
And of course, you know, this was just the subject of the plenary presentation by your colleague, Dr. Berger, at the ASCO meeting, which we'll talk a little bit about. But I have to say that one of the things that really struck me was that issue of giving an IV placebo to somebody for 14 months. How did this woman respond to the idea she might be coming in for that over a year and getting a placebo?
Well, that was a very contentious issue for a long period of time, and we were concerned that people would not want to participate in a trial where they were going to get placebo. But I think there was so much interest in bevacizumab, and it was not available otherwise in participating in that trial, that I think women participated. Now, I know there were some women who did not want to participate in that trial because they wanted to get bevacizumab, and consequently, they sometimes did wind up paying for bevacizumab by themselves together with chemotherapy.
No, I know, maybe not exactly in tandem, but roughly around the same time, the NSABP was doing their adjuvant study in colon cancer. And what they saw there, again, that same sort of thinking that you were just talking about, people were excited about it. It was the only way they could get Bev. And I know that trial accrued extremely quickly. I think they got 2,600 people on in 2 years. Overall, how quickly was the accrual to 218?
This trial accrued very rapidly. Initially, it was for patients with just bulky disease, and they were patients such as this woman were initially not allowed to enter because they wanted people like that to be shunted toward intraperitoneal studies. But in fact, there were many people who, you know, felt that that was not really ethical in some sense, and it was a good patient population in whom perhaps bevacizumab would show its greatest benefit in those patients who had the smallest amount of disease. So the protocol was amended to include women with optimal macroscopic disease such as her, and then I think the accrual even picked up quicker. So it accrued very rapidly.
So, of course, she didn't know what she was randomized to, but I guess at some point you found out that she actually got the maintenance bevacizumab. How did she do on the treatment, both the chemo-bev as well as the maintenance?
Well, she experienced the usual toxicity of the chemotherapy with paclitaxel carboplatin, but it was tolerable, and she was able to basically get complete doses of carboplatin paclitaxel. And then she tolerated the bevacizumab well. There were some issues with blood pressure, so people were speculating that she was on the bevacizumab arm. And then when the results became public, people were told what they had received, and then it turned out that she did, in fact, have the bevacizumab.
Now, one of the things we've heard a lot about in other tumors have been nosebleeds with bevacizumab. What we hear is not too major, you know, sort of drying in the mucosa, but that it's very frequent. Did she have any, and what's been your experience in general?
Yeah, actually, she did have a nosebleed, and it was at a time when she wasn't thrombocytopenic, so it may have been related certainly to the bevacizumab, but it was just one time, and it didn't require any serious type of intervention, but it did occur.
So she received what turned out to be her maintenance bevacizumab, and then what happened?
Well, then she did very well for about 18 months after she had finished her chemotherapy, and then her CA-125 started rising again. And then that led to the CT scan, which showed that she had some regrowth of some of the disease, and she's now in the process of deciding exactly what kind of treatment she should get.
Now, is she symptomatic from the disease?
At this point, she's starting to get some of the symptoms again of the bloating that led to the initial diagnosis as well.
So she actually has not been treated yet?
No, no.
What are the options that you're thinking about or have discussed with her?
Well, we were thinking about, certainly she would fall in the category of platinum-sensitive disease. And recently, there have been some randomized studies which have helped us direct how best to treat this group of patients. Years ago, the standard treatment was to retreat these patients with single-agent carboplatin. But then there have been a couple of trials which have shown that retreating them with carboplatin combinations, such as carboplatin paclitaxel or carboplatin gemcitabine, did better than platinum. And more recently, though, the randomized trial, the Calypso study, compared carboplatin paclitaxel with pegylated liposomal rubicin carboplatin, and that combination seemed to be perhaps even better, not as far as perhaps outcomes go, because there was no direct improvement in survival, but the toxicity was quite tolerable. So she, I think, is leaning right now. And the physicians are talking to her, and we've been talking to her about being treated with PLD plus carboplatin.
Now, what about reintroducing bevacizumab?
Well, that's going to be one of the major questions. And we don't know whether these patients will continue to have benefit from bevacizumab. And of course, we don't know for sure whether she herself actually had, as an individual, had benefit from bevacizumab. But there are some randomized trials in platinum-sensitive patients now that are looking at whether bevacizumab added will make an improvement compared to, for example, gemcitabine carboplatin alone. So we don't have that data yet. And I think right now she would prefer to have something relatively straightforward and with a good chance of having a good remission and relatively non-toxic.
So the question of the day or the month that I've been asking a lot of people is, what does GOG-218 mean?
That's a very good question, and you're going to hear different interpretations of what it really means. And there were a couple of things that were really interesting. First of all, in ovarian cancer, bevacizumab as a single agent had quite remarkable activity. In a phase 2 trial, and mainly in platinum, even resistant patients, there was about a 20% response rate. Now, that's in contrast to the other tumors where Bev has been approved, where it basically it potentiates the benefit of chemotherapy. And a single agent, bevacizumab, really didn't have much activity in breast cancer or colon cancer or lung cancer, but it was in combination with chemotherapy that it really had its benefit. So we expected in 218, in many ways, that here the drug that was active in its own right, and we hoped that it would potentiate chemotherapy. So we, you know, many of us were very hopeful that this would be, in fact, a positive result. And it was positive. It met its endpoint, but the endpoint was progression-free survival. And it statistically met its endpoint, but it was right around 4 months or 3.8 months improvement in progression-free survival. And it was only in the arm where the bevacizumab was continued as maintenance therapy. Many of us would have predicted that arm number two, where the patients received chemotherapy plus bevacizumab just during the course of the chemotherapy, that would have been positive as well, because that's what was positive in the other diseases where bevacizumab has been approved. But it wasn't positive, and there was no improvement in survival or progression-free survival in arm 2. It was only in arm 3. So then I raised the whole question, why wasn't it positive in arm 2? Second of all, do you really need to give it during chemotherapy? Because arm 3, where it was positive, was with chemotherapy followed by maintenance. So the question, well, do you really need to give it with chemotherapy? And is it better perhaps just to wait till you get a complete remission and then add the bevacizumab? Or even because it's such an active drug as a second-line agent, perhaps you could even not treat those patients until they progress and then use the bevacizumab. So this trial asked more questions than it answered. Now, the other thing, of course, is in this day and age, we've got to be cognizant of the cost-benefit of this, and people have argued, and the discussion at ASCO talked about the issue. You're basically talking about, you know, $70,000 plus for improvement in progression-free survival. And the overall survival data was early, but it's probably unlikely that the overall survival will be positive. So we're dealing just with progression-free survival improvement, Now, in its own right, progression-free survival is a good endpoint because it's not going to be mixed up by subsequent treatments. And I think it definitely shows some benefit, but exactly where that benefit came, did it come because of the whole extended period of bevacizumab following chemotherapy, or do you really need it with chemotherapy? We don't know. And I'm not sure there will be any trials that will answer that. There's another European study which is similar to this that's ongoing, and patients are randomized to paclitaxel carbo or paclitaxel plus carboplatin with bevacizumab at a lower dose of bevacizumab and svelte maintenance therapy. So that study should be available in about a year. There are other antiangiogenic compounds that are being tested in randomized trials just in patients who are in a clinical complete remission. So perhaps we'll have some more insight into how to do this in the future. But I think the oncologist in practice is in a little bit of a quandary about this. I mean, he's got to talk with the patient. This is going to be more toxic. I don't know. I'm sure the company would be going to the FDA and seeking approval. I suspect that'll be sometime in the next 6 or 9 months. And if they do get FDA approval, then that'll facilitate certainly reimbursement. But it's going to be a complicated thing for 3.8 months improvement in progression-free survival, which is basically a couple of office visits. And do you really, is that worth all the treatment and all the expense? And I think that's something that patients and physicians are going to have to wrestle with.
So how are you thinking this through on a practical level right now in your own practice? I mean, if this lady or maybe a lady like her was younger, shows up, do you bring it up as an option? Do you recommend it? Do you recommend against it? What do you tell people?
Well, right now, I would certainly recommend that they consider it. And I think the consensus, not a real consensus, but certainly from Dr. Eisenhower's discussion and the ASCO talk, and Dr. Berger said it should be considered a option. It's not something that is everybody's going to say you must do, that this is really the best treatment available. I think you have to just discuss it with the patient. I certainly would lean toward using it, certainly. I mean, I agree that progression-free survival is a benefit, and 4 months is a benefit, but there is some toxicity. I think that patients have to be aware of that, but I think it's certainly a good option, and I think many patients and many oncologists will use it. Many oncologists, of course, are very familiar using bevacizumab and other diseases, so they're not going to be scared of using this agent, and I think we're getting better versed to dealing with some of the side effects and toxicities, and it's manageable. The hypertension is manageable. So quality of life is really pretty good. I don't think in the GOG study there was much difference in quality of life between any of the arms. So I think it's certainly an acceptable option. And I think there will be a debate by the healthcare providers, I think, about paying for this. But that's something that, you know, we'll see how that plays out with the healthcare reform and so forth.
I guess also hopefully maybe we'll get more data from this study, and particularly getting more data from other trials like the ION study. And I guess right. The ION study also, I think, looked at earlier stage disease in addition.
Right. They had some earlier stage disease. They had half the dose of bevacizumab. So, you know, no trials are absolutely comparable. So if it's totally negative, I think it'll be pause for reflection. If it's positive, hopefully it will be. And hopefully that'll add to the database that we can use this and should use this.
How about your 65-year-old woman with the BRCA1 mutation?
This has been a very exciting area in ovarian cancer, development of the PARP inhibitors. About 10% of patients carry BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutations, and they're part of the breast ovarian syndrome, where they're higher risk for breast and ovarian cancer. And what has obviously been developed, exciting, is the fact now we understand a little bit more what BRCA1 and BRCA2 do. They are DNA repair genes. And all tissues need DNA repair genes, whether they're normal tissues or tumor tissues. Even a tumor is undergoing all sorts of events from radiation and so forth, and it needs to repair its genome. So tumor cells have very little BRCA activity. They lost a germline mutation, and also they lose, when they become tumors, they lose the other alleles. So there's very little DNA repair activity based upon BRCA1 or BRCA2. So they're dependent upon this other pathway called the PARP pathway, which in most tissues is relatively inconsequential because you have a much more powerful DNA repair pathway and functioning BRCA1 and BRCA2. So these PARP inhibitors were polyadenosyl ribose, sometimes transferase, which is a minor DNA repair pathway, and they developed oral drugs which specifically block that pathway. And in tumor cells now, in patients who are BRCA1 or BRCA2 positive, these tumor cells are very much dependent upon this PARP pathway to repair their genome. And if you block that pathway, they suddenly have no ability to repair their DNA, and they apoptose. And so these drugs have shown remarkable activity. And last year at ASCO, a drug showed to have dramatic activity in a phase 1 trial where we hardly ever see. We're looking, hopefully, to see one response, but they saw a wide variety of responses, some complete responses in platinum-resistant or BRCA1 patients. So that kindled a lot of excitement about that. So theoretically, this should work very well as a single agent and in combination chemotherapy for patients with BRCA1, BRCA2 positive tumors. But it also may have activity in a sporadic type, because it appears that about 30 to 40% of serous tumors have what's called BRCA-ness, in the sense that even though they have no specific mutations in BRCA1, they have some inactivity of the BRCA activity based on the activity may be blocked on methylation and so forth. So they're functioning as if they don't have any very active BRCA1. So they also may be sensitive to these PARP inhibitors. So PARP inhibitors are going to be also studied not only in the BRCA1 positive patients, but in these patients who are with sporadic ovarian cancer. This particular woman, as all BRCA1 positive patients have, they actually do a little bit better with chemotherapy because, again, the platinum works a little bit better because they don't have as vibrant a DNA repair capacity. But they ultimately do relapse and progress like most advanced ovarian cancer patients. And she had gone through a wide variety of drugs. And then she was treated at another institution and called me up and we talked, and she had not heard about BRCA1 and she lived in Boston. I said, you got to see if you can get BRCA1 and inhibitor, a PARP inhibitor. And she got it. And she was symptomatic. Her performance status had decreased. She had a lot of pain. She had digestive issues. And got an email from her after about 6 months. She said she was traveling to Israel with her daughter and celebrating her daughter's graduation from high school, was totally asymptomatic and doing great. So, you know, this is kind of a Lazarus-type resurrection that we hardly ever see from an oral drug that had no significant toxicity. So this drug, again, and there are several companies that are making these PARP inhibitors, and they're being tested very rigorously, and there are some randomized trials that are in progress right now comparing them with standard treatment in relapsed patients. But I would suspect that certainly in the BRCA1 positive patients, this is going to be a major breakthrough.
Now, did she have a family history of breast or ovarian cancer?
Yes. Mm.
And that's how she came to be tested?
Yeah. Mm.
And I see from your write-up that this woman received olaparib. What do we know about the side effects and toxicities of this agent?
They're very moderate because your normal tissues they have BRCA functioning, so they're not dependent upon this pathway, and essentially almost no toxicity from these agents.
How about your 60-year-old woman?
This is a woman who went through the usual scenario of developing symptoms of ovarian cancer and was diagnosed with advanced disease and had a very good surgery and had very little disease left. And she elected to have intraperitoneal chemotherapy. And she wanted to be aggressive, and sometimes patients use that term aggressive as if there's no other option, but she was not treated with FOXA. She came to us afterwards. But she did receive intraperitoneal chemotherapy similar to what was used, or basically identical to what was used in the GOG study, which was, unfortunately now, time goes fast, but was published in the New England Journal about 5 years ago. And that study showed that in comparison to intravenous Taxol and platinum, intraperitoneal platinum had an improvement in overall survival in patients with optimal stage 3 disease. And this led to a National Cancer Institute issuing an alert and announcement saying that people should consider this treatment. But this study, again, there was a lot of controversy about it, and I'm sure when you've talked to other ovarian cancer doctors, some will feel very strongly that this is a standard of care. Others will have issues about it. Like, personally, I feel that unfortunately, that study had the wrong control arm. Carboplatin paclitaxel should have been used because I think that's better and may not have led to the improvement in survival that they reported. And plus, the toxicity was extremely tough. Only about 40% of patients could complete intraperitoneal therapy. Patients suffered from severe neurotoxicity from the platinum intraperitoneal paclitaxel that was administered. Quality of life was bad. And again, when you think about it, in the GOG study where people who participate in trials are motivated and they want to do what the doctor tells them on a trial. And yet, in this particular trial, only 42% could finish the 6-cycle of treatment. So in the real world, with patients having many more comorbid illnesses, I think intraperitoneal therapy would even be more difficult to tolerate. And I think toxicity was due to the intraperitoneal platinum, which was used at a very high dose of 100 milligram per meter squared, and to the intraperitoneal paclitaxel on day 8. I think we had some major concerns about it, and even the GOG, since that article was published, they've still been debating about which subsequent trial to use, and now they are going to do another trial of intraperitoneal therapy, but the control arm will be intravenous carboplatin and paclitaxel. So if the GOG still thinks that you need another trial, then I think the doctor in practice can certainly use intraperitoneal therapy if he wants, but I think there's no pressure that this has been proven to be the best treatment. And this particular woman, she had a complete remission. She didn't have much disease left after her surgery, and so she went through the intraperitoneal therapy and developed grade 2 or grade 3 neuropathy, which is very common in this group of patients. And then when she relapsed, again, that limited the options for treatment. And then at that point, we certainly wouldn't go back to paclitaxel and would recommend that she receive a non-paclitaxel regimen at the time of progression. So we don't know what the long-term benefit of that GOG study. They haven't reported the long-term results of intraperitoneal therapy. And it would be nice to see some more data comparing the end result of intraperitoneal type regimens versus the intravenous carboplatin paclitaxel. I should mention in the GOG study that's being done, one of the arms is using intraperitoneal carboplatin instead of intraperitoneal cisplatin so that they can try to perhaps avoid some of the toxicity that was such a problem with the original regimen.
What exactly are the three arms, including bevacizumab?
Yeah, three arms. One arm is going to be intravenous chemotherapy. One arm is going to be intraperitoneal cisplatin, and the third arm is going to be intraperitoneal carboplatin. And there's some issues still. They were going to add bevacizumab to all three arms if GOG 218 was positive, and I still think they're struggling now whether they should mandate bevacizumab in all three arms now. I'm not sure what the outcome is going to be. They're going to have a meeting this July, and they'll decide about whether that study should have intravenous paclitaxel in all three arms.
Remind me again of the control arm in the initial intraperitoneal study.
Yeah, in the control arm in the initial study with intravenous cisplatin and intravenous paclitaxel. Now, before that, we did this large study of intravenous carboplatin taxol versus intravenous cisplatin taxol. And actually, we showed in that GOG study that there was wasn't statistically significant, but there was almost a significant improvement in survival in patients who received carboplatin paclitaxel. So this study was thought, initially people thought that the carboplatin paclitaxel would not be as good as cisplatin paclitaxel. That's why we had to do this large randomized comparison, GOG 158. But it actually surprised some people that the intravenous carboplatin paclitaxel was superior as far as outcomes go, or almost statistically superior. So if you use that arm and compare it, I mean, these cross-trial comparisons are just somewhat informative, and people argue about how informative. But if you plot the intravenous carboplatin paclitaxel against the intraperitoneal regimen in GOG 172, the statistical difference in survival goes away.
Now, this woman developed her relapse 6 months after finishing treatment.
Right.
What were the options that you discussed with her?
Well, and this is that group of patients where you come into that borderline of, I mean, are they platinum sensitive? Are they platinum resistant? It becomes a little bit gray zone. Certainly people who relapse more than 12 months after finishing therapy are definitely platinum sensitive. In the 6 to 12 month range, sort of intermediate. I think most people would still try to give this patient the benefit of the doubt of adding a carboplatin still and adding a non-carboplatin drug such as Doxil or gemcitabine. She received gemcitabine and carboplatin because we didn't have the data from the Doxil study at that point, and there was this randomized trial of carboplatin versus carboplatin plus gemcitabine in patients such as her who were more than 6 months out from their completion of therapy when they relapsed, and the gem carbo was superior.
And how did she do?
She had a good remission, and I mean, it completely normalized her markers again, but had a subsequent relapse and then was treated with drugs like Doxil and topotecan.
How did she do on the gem-carbo in terms of side effects?
She had the usual side effects on the gem-carbo, and then they related to the myelosuppression, which is the biggest problem with that regimen. And by dose modification, we were able to handle that pretty effectively.
Let's close out with your take on some other new research strategies. First, one agent presented at ASCO, farlemtuzumab.
Yeah, the folate receptor has been a target in some other studies, and it's been shown that ovarian cancer tumors have overexpression of folate receptors, and particularly one type of an alpha folate receptor, and antibodies have been developed against this folate receptor, and they're being studied. And phase 2 data looked promising, and they're being studied together with chemotherapy. So those studies, I think, were presented some update this year, but I think they're very interesting. But we don't have an open study at this point. I think those studies are almost closed now.
One question I've been asking ovarian investigators in the last couple of years because of our previous work, or a lot of our work in breast cancer in terms of anti-HER therapy, which is the question of anti-HER therapy in ovarian cancer. There's been work done on the agent pertuzumab. We're starting to see more of that in breast cancer. We had the TOGA trial in gastric cancer that came out looking at trastuzumab in that disease. What do we know about anti-HER therapy in ovarian cancer and pertuzumab specifically?
Well, years ago, when the first data first came out, Denny Slaman, it looked like there was an overexpression of HER2-new in about a third of ovarian cancer patients, but that was a selected population. Then when the GOG did a very large study looking at Herceptin in this group of patients and measuring overexpression of HER2-new, it was only about 10% of patients that had some overexpression, and there were very few responses. So for the classic epithelial ovarian cancer patient, we would not recommend Herceptin. Now, pertuzumab has been studied as well. This is a different type of monoclonal antibody. There were some data, the phase 1 agent that activity, and then there was some data together with some chemotherapy that was some benefit. But the numbers were small, and they were trying to identify markers which could predict which group of patients would, in fact, respond. And there were some issues about identifying some phosphorylation proteins that could predict which patients should respond. But right now, I don't know where this drug is going. I haven't seen any additional trials to the ones that were recently reported even a couple years ago at ASCO.
There was some stuff last year that was looking at some kind of marker. I think it was dimerization, but I didn't see anything this year.
Right, with phosphorylation of some of the proteins. Mm-hmm.
One final question about this woman. You were talking about the issue of treating the patient with platinum-sensitive disease in the recurrent setting, the different options. Can you talk a little bit more about how you decide between the various available options?
Yeah. So right now, the best drug that everybody, I think, would still agree with is that carboplatin is the single best drug for recurrent ovarian cancer. And I think we all would agree now that on the basis of randomized trials that adding another drug to carboplatin makes a benefit. So that drug could either be paclitaxel, that drug could be gemcitabine, and that combination was approved by the FDA on the basis of a trial in Europe comparing gemcarbo versus carbo, which showed an improvement in progression-free survival of about 3 months. And the third one, again, was the pegylated liposomal doxorubicin plus carbo. So all of those three are options for this group of patients. I think it comes down a lot to toxicity considerations, which one you select. Certainly if a patient had residual neuropathy, then one would shy away from paclitaxel carboplatin retreatment. In addition, we shouldn't underestimate the importance of hair loss. And for some women, you know, if they don't have to lose their hair, they don't want to do it. And gemcarbo and doxorubicin both don't have hair loss. In this randomized study, this CLIPSO trial of doxorubicin versus taxorubicin, it looked like the doxorubicin was actually doing better, but there wasn't any statistically significant improvement, and there was less toxicity. So I think right now many doctors are choosing the combination of doxorubicin plus carboplatin. The FDA-approved option is carboplatin plus gemcitabine, but I think PLD plus carbo makes a lot of sense.
What about docetaxel?
Docetaxel, I think, has sort of gone out of favor, and we don't use it very much. I think the thing about paclitaxel that is in the studies where it was compared was always, I think, a little less toxic. And the big thing with paclitaxel, maybe we should talk about, is that it wasn't updated this year, but last year at ASCO, the results reported from a Japanese study comparing a randomized trial of traditional taxol carbo with both drugs given every 3 weeks to a regimen where the carboplatin was administered every 3 weeks, but the paclitaxel was administered weekly. And that study was reported in Lancet follow-up this past, I think, 6-7 months ago, and it showed quite dramatic improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival. So one thing that I think an oncologist can consider right now is to not use paclitaxel carboplatin in the traditional way that we've been giving in ovarian cancer, but switch to paclitaxel given weekly together with carboplatin, because it's unlikely to be worse. And a GOG is going to do a confirmatory study of the Japanese study, and certainly putting patients on that study would be ideal. But outside of a clinical trial, I would recommend that patients consider, because it's a little bit more hassle coming every week, but the benefit appears to be significant. So weekly paclitaxel, again, has shown advantages in other tumor types. So it's not a surprise that in ovarian cancer it has a benefit. So weekly paclitaxel plus carboplatin is something that a physician can institute right now in patients with advanced ovarian cancer.
Anything else that happened at ASCO or has happened recently in the field that you want to comment on?
Well, I think the data at ASCO, the other data that was interesting, there were a couple randomized trials that came out in untreated patients. One was gemcarbo versus paclitaxel carbo. This was an untreated patient, and it really didn't show any advantage for the gemcarbo and maybe even some decreased efficacy. There was a study in untreated patients of paclitaxel carbo versus doxil carbo, and again, no clear-cut difference in outcomes, but certainly showed that doxil carbo could be a viable option. So I think at the end of the day, we are still left with carboplatin paclitaxel being a standard of care. And again, with the caveat that right now, I think the doctor in practice certainly should consider weekly paclitaxel together with the carboplatin in this group of patients. So there wouldn't, the biological therapies are all, you know, we're glad to see a positive result with bevacizumab, but we hope to see better.